This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Carol Rogers with the Indiana Business Research Center in Indianapolis, based at IUPUI, about the Stats Indiana website, a very handy website if you're doing some research work here in Indiana. Also, too, we get an update from Elizabeth Lynn at Valparaiso University about the next in the series of Pathways to Purpose speakers coming into the campus. And we'll also bring you as well another, actually two conversations from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The explosion of the internet in the last few years in particular have made it so much easier for Hoosiers to find out information about their particular counties on a number of different topics. And the state government is helping out as well, too, by offering that information. It's making it available through the systems. And at IUPUI in Indianapolis, the Indiana University Business Research Center is able to put all this together into a special website, which is called Stats Indiana. And to talk more about Stats Indiana, we have the curator of Stats Indiana with us, Carol Rogers, Deputy Director of the IU Business Research Center. She's also the Chief Information Officer, and she's joining us from her office in Indianapolis. Carol, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you so much. Happy to participate with you, and I come from the region.
Well, that's good. That's nice to do that.
Absolutely. So I grew up in La Porte.
Well, that's certainly the part of us, and we have listeners in La Porte and members as well in La Porte, and we appreciate all their help as well, too. And we thought that this would be a great opportunity, at the very least, to explain in particular how Northwest Indiana residents can take advantage of Stats Indiana and learn something about the region in particular. If you will first, Carol, kind of explain how Stats Indiana got started.
It actually got started back in the early 1970s, believe it or not. This was a bit before my time with the research center, but our center has actually been around since 1925. We were one of the first research centers at Indiana University and the first one in the School of Business. And our mission has always been to study the people and economies of Indiana. So, of course, in order to do that, you have to collect data. And by the early 1970s, we had transferred much of the data we collected about the economy and population and building permits and housing data. We loaded it all onto an IBM computer and made it available through public libraries during the 70s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then by the early 90s, we translated everything to the internet, to what they used to call the World Wide Web.
Yes, that's right. That's right. When you got this information, the raw data that you basically had, what sources did you have to go to, or did I should say the center have to go to, actually, to be able to go through this and in turn, at that time, put it into the computer, and now, which is part of Stats Indiana? What sources do you go to for the data, and in what form do you have it?
Well, back in the day, we had people who actually did data entry. Back in the 70s and 80s, we translated it all by typing it in to the computer and storing it. Nowadays, we get things almost entirely through other digital files from the Census Bureau, National Center for Health Statistics, National Center for Education Statistics, the whole host of federal agencies, as well as state agencies like the Budget Agency, Department of Revenue, State Department of Health, Department of Education, you name it, we work with those state agencies to get data. And we also have built up special relationships with local governments to get data. We try to get as much tax data as possible. And so we have built up really now our website says 5 billion plus data records. We're up to 12 billion now because it just keeps, these data are like rabbits. Wow. They multiply.
I noticed that on the website, you talk in more detail here, not only about the fact that it's, I guess, basically Indiana's official digital data center, but also you offer up some interesting data stories too. How do these data stories get put together?
We actually power our research with data transformed through technology. That sounds pretty fancy, doesn't it?
But yeah.
we use We try to maximize the use of the technology to help us analyze the information that we have so that we can put together stories about, for example, the economic impact of opioid addiction in our state, or trying to understand specific types of industry sectors or clusters of industry. We do a lot of work in the area of workforce development, and underpinning a lot of this is one of our long-term specialties, which is really population, understanding how many people do we have in our counties and regions of the state. And we're getting ready to release in a couple of weeks our latest series of population projections by age for all of our counties. And I think folks are particularly interested in that because we want to know where we're headed, especially if we don't do anything.
I know that in one recent report within the last few months or so, we came out with a report on talking about population, and you went through the data, and we took note as well, too, on how the population of some of the communities in Lake County have grown, and it's kind of shown how the migration of people have been from one region to the other. For example, in Lake County, how some of the people that used to live in North Lake County in communities like Maryville, even Hammond, and Highland, and the like, or Whiting, how many of them have shifted now to South Lake County. They're living either out in the country, or they're living in communities like Lowell, or even Crown Point, for that matter, too, and Cedar Lake. They've taken advantage of the opportunities to move out in the open country, so to speak, and you note how the population shifts have been that way, too. Some of that earlier data is out there, so it'll be interesting to see how we translate that into some updates here with this new material coming out.
Yeah, and certainly one of the previews that I can give you prior to our release is that actually in our projections we see particularly strong growth for Porter and Jasper, which may interest a lot of people. I don't know that Porter County is necessarily surprised, but with Jasper County, certainly there's been a lot of both economic activity and residential development. And we get a lot of people who move into the region from the Chicago area.
That would be interesting to see how the data has really followed through on what we actually get to see. We see more houses and more people moving into communities and how communities are growing. Do communities in particular have the opportunity to use this data to be able to project what they need to do, not only for economic development, but to be able to deal with the problems that they're going to face if they're not facing them already, but when they have a higher population?
What Stats Indiana can do is give you the numbers and the trends. You know, trend lines are really critical. We always stress looking at the data over time to see where a particular place is going. And with those trend lines, you can also then try to compare yourself to other parts of the state or even the country, because Stats Indiana provides data through its USA counties and profile for every county in the nation.
Wow.
So all 3,100 of those counties. And you can compare yourself to other places that may be similar to you but may be experiencing either high growth or a sharp decline, and try to figure out why. Telling people, Stats Indiana isn't going to tell you what to do, but it can give you data about what others may have done to turn their trends around.
Right. Well, that's very important because, yeah, you say you're looking, everyone's looking for some examples so they can come up with some ideas where it may have worked someplace else, and they can try to see if they can apply it to a local situation, that's to be sure. We're talking with Carol Rogers, who's the Deputy Director and the Chief Information Officer for the IU Business Research Center, which is based at IUPUI. And one of the projects that they work on, among several, is one that's available to anybody right now on the internet by going onto the Stats Indiana website. It's billed as Indiana's official digital data center. And it's a great way to very easily, as you say, get the information for Indiana communities and counties, but also branch out to any community in the country, I would imagine, too. you set it up on the website for different things, and we've kind of mentioned about the data stories, and you mentioned one in particular that's available too, and you also talk about the very popular topics, and obviously I'm sure over the years that the folks there at the center have discovered through the data and the statistics that you put out there that there are some things that people want to know the most about, and you've kind of broken it down into popular topics, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. And what's been trending recently is our school district data and township data.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly for schools, for school corporations, and we also equate that into county-level data, especially for economic developers and realtors. But understanding how our schools are doing is always important. We have an interactive map that you can go to for the school data. And then also the township data and the county profiles are really popular.
I mentioned in particular this General Assembly session has had some issues that have come up, and bills have been proposed and reviewed involving such things as figuring out how redistricting should be done, in particular the size of townships, and talking about finding ways to consolidate townships across the state. So I'm sure that the information, I'm sure at one point in time probably came to hand in the lawmakers that came up with these bills, and they had this opportunity to put all this together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because we have population data going all the way back to 1900.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go in and again, because we're really big on those trends, which way are we headed, and you can look at township population or city and town population or county population, really over the past 11 decades worth of information that you can look at. And we try to go back in time as far as possible.
Now, it looks like it's easy to be able to get the information by going through the website. Give us, if you will, the address if people want to go online and look all this information up, how they can reach the Stats Indiana website.
Well, probably the easiest thing to do is just go to Google and type in Stats Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
The address, though, is www.stats.indiana.edu.
That's very simple in itself there. It would be easy to put that up, and it's very graphic and easy to see on the screen, and also easy to understand and to access as well, too. And we thank you very much, Carol Rogers, for explaining what Stats Indiana is all about, and look forward to for more people to take advantage of the opportunity to go online at the Stats Indiana website, find out whatever they happen to be interested in, and get the data that goes back so many years, and learn more about the Hoosier State, to be sure.
Maybe we can get together again sometime, and we'll talk to you about our Gateway for Indiana Government units.
Yes, I'd like to very much, because there are a number of things that the IU Business Research Center works on for Hoosiers, and this Stats Indiana website is just one of them. We will do so. Thank you very much, Carol, for being with us today. Carol Rogers is the Deputy Director and the CIO for the Indiana Business Research Center, based in Indianapolis. Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service is continuing to offer its very special speaker series called Pathways to Purpose. And to talk about it, we have the Executive Director of the Institute with us, Elizabeth Lynn. Elizabeth, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
No, nice to talk to you, Chris.
And we know that the program has already started on Valparaiso University with the first speaker.
Yes, each semester we bring in five or six really remarkable practitioners of leadership and service. We bring them to Valparaiso University. They spend a day on campus getting to know our students, faculty, and staff. We welcome community members as well to come to their public talks in the evening. And the goal of the program overall is to expand imagination about how we can lead and serve in the world, and particularly to show students how they can connect what they studied when they were at Valpo with those very creative pathways that leaders take to put their studies to work in service to the world. All of our speakers, the public presentations, are on Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm.
So all the dates I'll be giving will be Wednesdays. You can also go to our website, Institute for Leadership and Service at Valparaiso University. Just Google that. We'll come up and look up our schedule there. But she's speaking at 5:30 p.m. in the Helge Center, which is attached to the Chapel of the Resurrection, which is at the center of our campus. Mm-hmm. And
we're talking with Elizabeth Lynn, who is the executive director of Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service. And we're talking in particular about the Spring 2018 Pathways to Purpose speaker series. And there's another series of speeches coming up on February 21st. Tell us about this this digital age lady and why she's so important.
Yeah, she is definitely a digital age lady. Her name is Eva Krakul, and she's the executive director and co-founder of something called Glitch. Now, isn't that a great name for an organization? Glitch promotes the exploration of digital games as a culture, career, and creative practice. So they're a community-driven arts and education center based in the Twin Cities in Minnesota for emerging game makers, and they offer ongoing programs, events, residencies, and grants to support these emerging creators, makers, thinkers, and doers of new work in digital games. Mm-hmm. That's a very creative idea, and it would be wonderful to hear how she came up with it. I mean, the idea of a community organization that supports emerging digital game makers who are not recognized as established by others and who take risks and embrace challenges. That's a very creative kind of thing to do. And so how did Eva Krakul come to that? Mm-hmm. She studied neuroscience and psychology at the University of Minnesota. And we will help her tell her story of her pathway to purpose from studying those fields to creating something called Glitch.
Oh. Well, it'll be very interesting. I'm looking forward to find out more about her. Now, yeah. The series takes a break in March and comes back in April 25th, to be exact here, and kind of jumping over to the distaff side, we have a gentleman who's coming to campus to talk about investing in innovation. Tell us what Stephen Lehman's going to have to talk about.
Yeah. So Stephen Lehman's coming from a short distance, just the University of Chicago in Hyde Park in Chicago. He's a graduate of Valparaiso University. He did his bachelor's in mechanical engineering. Again, it's interesting to think, how does one get from mechanical engineering to investing in innovation at the University of Chicago? He holds an MBA from Notre Dame as well, and he studied the humanities. He is the assistant director of the University of Chicago Innovation Fund, which is an early stage fund dedicated to the commercialization of research and technology generated at the university. So they invest in promising startups from an ecosystem that includes not only the University of Chicago, but Argonne National Laboratory, Fermilab, and the Marine Biological Laboratory. Their core mission is to help researchers turn their innovations into ventures that advance cutting-edge technologies, generate significant financial returns, and create lasting impact for humankind. Again, it's interesting to think about how this kind of support of startups and technology can also be joined to our deepest values about what is of importance, what is good for humankind. And he's clearly thinking about that. And we'll be talking about that on April 25th, again at 5:30 p.m., and again in the Helge Center at Valparaiso University.
Now, this last in the series, the Pathways to Purpose series, is coming up on May 2nd. In fact, somebody I've heard of, and you may have heard her too, certainly NPR's Code Switch team oftentimes contributes features and stories to Morning Edition and All Things Considered and some of the other news magazines on NPR that you get to hear on Lakeshore Public Radio. But we get to have one of the founding members of Code Switch joining us here for this very special conversation. Tell us what Kat Chow is saying she's going to talk about.
Well, she's going to talk about telling complicated stories. And she really will help focus our attention on how we tell the complicated stories of race, ethnicity, and culture in our own society. She's just a remarkable person. She appears on NPR in a variety of contexts. Mm-hmm. So you might have heard her. She's an occasional chair on NPR's podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. She's worked with the show Invisibilia. And so she's also been involved with Local Lore. So those are all for NPR nerds. Those are all names to catch.
We picked her up on some of the Invisibilia pieces before on our programs too, yeah.
Excellent. excellent, wonderful program. And she is a founding member of Code Switch. Now, that's an award-winning team that covers these complicated stories that really weave through our experience every day here in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere. Stories of race, ethnicity, and culture. Mm-hmm. She makes new episodes for the Code Switch podcast, so you can check that out if you want to listen to the podcast. Reports online for Code Switch, and also does on-air pieces for shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Right. We should make a note, too, that Kat's presentation on May 2nd is not going to be at the Helge Center, as usual, but it is going to be in a very special place because we're expecting a big crowd to hear her. That's going to happen at the Duesenberg Recital Hall, isn't it?
Yes, that's in the Valparaiso University Center for the Arts, and is a lovely, lovely, small, but slightly larger than our own space here at the Helge Center Recital Hall. So you would want to get here early to get a seat, but you will really be in a very intimate and comfortable recital hall, getting to hear it from this phenomenal creative person in the world of radio, and also thinking about race, culture, gender, and identity. Yeah. May 2nd, and it's also, I just want to mention, it's at 5 p.m., not 5:30 that night.
Okay, and that's going to be a great way to close out the Pathways to Purpose series for the spring of 2018. And once again, Elizabeth, if anybody has any questions, they'd like to get the list of the speakers. We kind of run down them here briefly. Where folks find that list?
Yeah, just go to the Valparaiso University website and search for Institute for Leadership and Service, or just Google Pathways to Purpose at valpo.edu, and it'll pop right up. And so all the details are there. You can also follow us on Facebook, Institute for Leadership and Service at Valparaiso University. We have a very savvy social media team, and they keep it very well populated with information about our programs. We have not just Pathways to Purpose, but other public events we support from time to time throughout the year. And if you haven't been to the campus of Valparaiso University recently or at all, this is a great way to get to know us as a, I think, a real treasure in the region, in the country, and in the world. So I hope your listeners will come and join us on their own Pathways to Purpose.
Well, I certainly hope so, too. Elizabeth Lynn, thank you very much for telling us about this particular interesting series as it continues on for the spring of 2018 and all the great speakers coming to Valparaiso University this spring. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Take care.
This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I am originally from a small rural area in southeast Arkansas. I live on a farm. Growing up on a farm is very different from a lot of people's childhoods, I've learned. Because most of my days as a young Arkansan were spent outside. Like, I didn't get to watch television, didn't have a computer, didn't have a phone, didn't have a game console. So, like, we would spend most of our days with my grandpa, and he would say, go outside, and we would go outside. Having grown up like this, yes, I would say definitely there are people that don't understand this difference between living in a fairly isolated place versus and then coming to a more populated place, because it doesn't make sense to them to have to sit and contemplate what you've seen on the day, because you're used to having time to sit back and say, okay, I've seen this, what does it mean, what can I do with it, how do I feel about it? So it seems a little strange to them when I get, like, people overload, because they're like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you want to talk to anyone? It's like, well, because I've talked to 5 other people today. I can't take anymore. There's definitely a you're weird, why does this bother you kind of dynamic. There are many, many assumptions about rural communities. Most of them are kind of goofy stereotypes, like you don't have straight teeth and you still use outhouses, or like you're not intelligent because you've grown up with nothing but coyotes and rabbits for company. I don't want to be thought to be less intelligent than everybody else around me just because I didn't grow up with like 15 different friends and social events every day, because you can learn a lot about life just by being in the woods versus in a city. But a lot of people get kind of nervous about, like, oh, you're taking me into the woods, what are you going to do to me? So it's kind of hard to bridge that gap. The woods are actually a beautiful place. I mean, yeah, they're kind of scary in the dark if you don't know where you are, but if you just pay attention and go with somebody, you can learn a lot.
My son and I just have a one-bedroom apartment, but we don't need much. I mean, he has the bedroom, I sleep in the living room. It's not a big deal. For $473 a month, we have a home. It's nice, it's clean, it's near things. There's air conditioning in the summer. There's heat in the winter. All the basic needs we need. Housing opportunities help to make things more affordable for people in my type of position where I'm just receiving Social Security disability, which is only $1,200 a month. It's hard to live on that. For me, it's difficult. For me to ask for help, it's very difficult. Maybe it's because I was told no, because when I wanted the food stamps and they said, no, I make too much money. And then I think, well, maybe I am doing something wrong because $1,280 a month is what I get. And I'm not eligible for food stamps with two people in the house. So what is the poverty level? There, at the end of the month, we have nothing. And we're waiting for the month to end so we can get paid again for the following month from Social Security. And it's not a healthy way to live. It's stressful, very, very stressful sometimes, because there's mornings that you wake up and you think, I don't know what I'm going to do for dinner tonight. And you're rummaging through your cabinets and you're pulling things together and making a mishmash of what you have. But sometimes it's that bad. Sometimes it's really bad. And thank God for the food pantry, because that's what I usually do, is I usually save it to the end of the month when things are bad, and then I go and I get something from the shelter that they have there for food for a week. I'd be lying if I'd say no. There were times that I did see that there were too many people that were on food stamps or too many people that were taking things that they shouldn't rightfully take. I have changed 360 on that. Because I know I've been victimized by it. So I know now that those people that do get the food stamps or do get government housing or Section 8 or whatever it may be, get it because they deserve it or they've earned it or they in a situation that there is no answer. But not sometimes until you go through it do you understand what it's like to be in that position where there is no other answer. That's what opened my eyes.
And you can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The Northwest Indiana Food Council is getting ready for its second annual food expo and discussion this coming weekend. Ann Massey with the Food Council was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
We wanted to do something kind of like a conference or a summit, but that wasn't so formal and still allowed people to learn and network from each other. So last year we had our first food expo and discussion, which we call FED, in March, and this will be our second year with our theme Just Food, which is kind of a play on words because it is all about food, but it's also going to be about food justice this year and social inequity in our food system in our community.
When you talk about food justice, what does that really mean?
It's addressing food insecurity. We have a lot of food deserts in the Northwest Indiana region. Over 110,000 people are food insecure or struggle to feed their families on a daily basis, and it's an issue that is very important and we want to address as a community.
Now, you're talking about bringing people together from the entire region, so we're talking about Lake and Porter and LaPorte and Newton and Jasper and Stark counties and Pulaska County, which is even further to the east there. So you have a lot of people, I think, that are certainly very interested in dealing with the problems of food deserts and, as you say, and food inequality. So I'm sure that a lot of people have wanted to get together for this second annual event and really take off to follow through on last year's event, for that matter, and all the other things that have happened in between.
Yeah, absolutely. We pride ourselves in taking a positive and optimistic approach to solving problems within our food system. And we think FED is a really fun day to think about issues that we need to address and to network so that our food entrepreneurs, our farmers, our city planners and community activists can all work together, share ideas and resources so that we can build a local food system together that's strong.
Now, who are you reaching out to here in Northwest Indiana to attend the event and participate in it?
Sure. Well, the event is going to be Friday, February 23rd from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., and we are inviting pretty much anyone that eats food. If you're a community activist, farmer, entrepreneur, city planner, from a faith-based organization, we have programming for you. If you are just someone who's interested in learning more about where your food comes from, who grows our food, or local stakeholders who are working to make food access or food more accessible in our region. This is also a great event for someone who wants to find out more as a consumer.
Mm-hmm. Will you give us an idea of some of the things that are going to be happening during the day, some of the discussion groups that are going to be getting together?
Sure. Tickets are only $20, and that's for all programming, and it includes a local food lunch. We start the day out with a producer-buyer speed networking, which is kind of like speed dating for producers and buyers. It's high energy. It's a great way to meet and network with people who may be able to help get your product out there on the market, or for buyers, it's a really nice way to meet farmers. If you're a small business or a home chef, it's really neat to meet farmers who are local and who may not have the scale to go to larger markets but are still looking for some interesting buyers to go to. We follow that up with our panel, which will talk in more depth about food insecurity and food access in Northwest Indiana, to kind of fill people in on where our food deserts are. They're not just urban. We also have plenty of rural food deserts as well. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of it'll be an interesting topic to discuss as our keynote. We'll have three rounds of workshops, which will be over anything from food access to marketing for food businesses and startups, grants and funding, alternative resources like foraging, time banking, food swaps, permaculture and soil health. We kind of run the gambit there on topics. And then over lunch, we'll have a local food lunch prepared by the PAC Center, which is a great organization in LaPorte, and also a vendor expo and farmers market, so people can kind of shop around and see what businesses are out there, and also some programming, too, for activists and farmers. Our day will end with a collaborative visioning exercise where we'll get together to start writing a plan for the local food system of Northwest Indiana.
We're talking with Ann Massey, who is with the Northwest Indiana Food Council, and they're one of the major sponsors for the second annual Food Expo and Discussion, or better known as FED, which is happening on February 23rd. It's going to happen, by the way, at the County Line Orchard, which, of course, is right at the Lake and Porter County lines. It sounds like that you took an opportunity from last year's first event to be able to build on it, to be able to create something for this year. But did you find some ways to be able to kind of incorporate what you learned as well from the farm hop tours that were held last year?
Yes, absolutely. After FED last year, we realized that people were really craving more networking. In Northwest Indiana, sometimes we can be really siloed, and our projects don't feel very connected. So our goal was to improve those relationships and connections over the course of 2017, which we feel we did. And we met a lot of farmers through our farm hop and some new people that we hadn't met at our FED event last year. So this year we're incorporating more workshops, programming, and resources for beginning farmers, homesteaders, and even gardeners, too. So you can contact us at info@northwestindianafoodcouncil.org if you'd like to find out more about or look it up on our website at nwifoodcouncil.org.
That's Ann Massey, who's the Executive Director of the Northwest Indiana Food Council. Tickets are still available at $20 before the event this weekend and $25 at the door at County Line Orchard. The computer science field is booming, but women are still underrepresented within it. The research shows that one reason is that girls aren't as exposed to computer science in grades K through 12. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting Charlotte Tuggle reports in the first of a two-part series, universities are reaching out to schools to try to introduce computing a little earlier.
And when we push the play button, it'll do whatever it says.
That's Kira Southard, one of three girls at Terre Haute's Lost Creek Elementary School, building a robot after classes have ended for the day. The other groups are all made up of boys, but that doesn't bother Southard.
All the boys are getting a little wild, but we like to get stuff done.
The project is part of Makerspace Club, a program aimed at introducing kids to computer science. After the robot is assembled, they'll be able to program it to move using a tablet computer. David Fisher, a Rose Holman Institute of Technology computer science professor, is a mentor for the program. He also organizes a summer camp for elementary and middle school students to introduce them to coding.
Whenever we kind of make the advertisement, we'll try to emphasize the fact that you can really do something with it, which tends to attract girls better, and also the opportunity for creativity tends to attract girls better.
He says the first year they held the camp, there was an even gender split in the elementary school group. But in the middle school group, there was just one girl who registered. So they had to even it up via extra recruitment. A recent study shows when many girls stop thinking about computer science. The data suggests it happens most in high school, either because computing isn't taught or it's no longer enjoyable to girls. But university officials are trying to combat both of those issues. Many have thrown their support behind Governor Eric Holcomb's proposal to require a computer science class in every high school. Purdue University senior Yanka Gall went to a high school that did offer CS classes. Before then, she hadn't even realized that she could major in computer science. Gall, like many other women in the field, was more invested once she heard about computing's real-world applications, such as the app she created in class that she can use to make digital scrapbooks.
I think it looks nice and it works, and so it's like cool to have something that I helped make and that does something and that we like made from scratch.
That's exactly what universities are stressing during a major rebranding of CS. Purdue distributes targeted marketing materials to prospective female students. They feature women in the department, as well as student organizations and careers for so-called changemakers. Back at Rose Holman, CS professor David Mutchler is focusing on breaking stereotypes, specifically referencing the longtime use of video games in computer science imagery.
Video games then, and still today, are largely directed at boys. There are some great games for girls now, but there were none 10 years ago. So that image is what kept us from getting anywhere.
That image of the boys' club still persists, though. For example, according to Computer Science for All, a federal program aimed at increasing diversity in CS, male computer scientists and engineers outnumber women 5-1 on television. And in family films, the disparity is nearly 3 times as wide. Rose Holman engineering professor Carlotta Berry says despite being exposed to computer science, that kind of portrayal has a lasting ability to turn girls away from the field.
There's this image that stuff's for boys. Boys program, boys are good at math, boys are good at science. Girls shouldn't do that stuff. So once they get that stigma in their mind, it's kind of really hard to get them back.
Universities have focused on getting girls attracted to computer science early, then sustaining that interest until it's time to pick a college. Purdue and Rose Holman both report increases in female computer science students in the past few years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle in West Lafayette.
And Charlotte will continue her series a little bit later in the program. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Design technology students at the Ivy Tech Community College over in Valparaiso have helped come up with a 3D model of a car part for none other than famous TV celebrity Jay Leno. And for that, we find out more from Jason Gordon, head of the department of the design technology program there at Ivy Tech in Valparaiso. And Jason, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris.
And we're being joined as well, too, by Susan Perry, who is the Dean of Technology for Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, Valentina Petruski, who is a member of the program and a member of the team that helped work on this part. Thank you both to you, Susan, and to Valentina for being with us as well.
Design technology is it's a wonderful growing field right now. It's really the language of technology. We teach all kinds of software programs here, AutoCAD and SolidWorks and Revit, BIM, all kinds of stuff like that. And we're actually venturing into Fusion starting next year. So we're really excited. We have a lot of employers calling us at this time, and we're doing all kinds of interesting things with architecture and graphic design, and in our case here with the Jay Leno part, mechanical design, mm-hmm. using our new 3D printer, a Strata system printer that's state-of-the-art.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about this part. It's a 1929 Duesenberg that Jay Leno owns. How did he end up having to have this part in the first place?
Well, I read on the I read that he's actually got a few 3D printers himself, but they're not the top-of-the-line printers. And I thought, you know, this would be a wonderful project for our students to get involved in. A lot of them are, of course, fans of his show, and He was looking. I contacted his agent. He actually gave me a call back, which really surprised me. And he had mentioned that he really likes to help schools and education, and that's a passion of his. So he wanted to help us, and I got a call from his mechanic the next day, and they sent a STL file to us, and we were able to print it later that week.
That's great. That's great. What is the difference that you've noted in being able to create a car part by the 3D printer as compared to, say, you know, taking that part, putting it in a sand mold, and casting something out of metal from it?
Well, often what will happen is that you print the 3D part first, and then you may do a casting after that. There's times where the parts don't exist anymore, or you may have a part that has been scanned that's damaged, and we can digitally reproduce that and correct the problem. Say there's a dent in the part or part of it is missing. We can correct that, 3D print it, and then it can be cast.
Richard Morose is a member of the staff there at Ivy Tech Valparaiso, and he's instructor in the class involving robotics. Rich, if you will, tell us a little bit about the 3D printer that was used to make this part for Jay Leno or for his Duesenberg.
Well, this 3D printer works similar to a inkjet printer. It has several nozzles. It uses a liquid resin that's ejected from these nozzles, and it does several passes. And then it's cured by a UV light. Each layer is cured by a UV light, and as the part is built from the bottom up. And then it's basically that's it. I mean, it works different than other 3D printers. It's more precise, and it's more detailed.
Mm-hmm. 5 thou, it'll be as precise as 5 thou of an inch, which is basically the spec for machining with a CNC machine.
Uh-huh. Now, is this part now stronger than something either the original part that might have been made for the original Duesenberg, or even for that matter a remanufactured part? That, you know, like I said, if you try to cast something or with some other material, is this new part made by the 3D printer stronger than the original?
Well, we have several materials we could make this part out of.
Mm-hmm.
There's 12 different materials that this printer can print. Basically, this part could be used. It's strong enough to use on a car, but it's strictly, he was going to use it to cast a one out of brass, I believe it was,
right,
and then have it chromed or whatever he was going to do.
Right? I see.
But what you might find interesting is that this 3D printer doesn't just do a poly, it'll also do a rubberized material, and will do clear material. A matter of fact, the part we printed was a clear material, and which can have all kinds of great applications. We also did a Harley-Davidson engine, didn't we, Richard?
It was a lawnmower engine.
Oh, it was a lawnmower engine?
Where
you can see the parts moving on the inside,
yeah,
because
uh-huh.
it's a clear material.
Well, it sounds like it would be great for instructional purposes that you can, you know, as far as trying to teach somebody how an internal combustion engine works, you know, something like the old days when toys were made out of plastic to see the working parts of a machine.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, today we're printing for our medical area here at Ivy Tech. We're printing an MRI version of a human brain. So that's made of a rubberized material, and so that our students over in nursing can look at it and study it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you should note that. Let's bring Susan Perry, the Dean of Technology there at Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, in on the conversation. Now, Susan, when you hear and learn about these things that the Design Technology Program has been doing, how does this fit into the overall mission of the department?
Oh, it just fits in perfectly, Chris. We're so happy to have this opportunity. And when Jason told me that he received a message from Jay Leno, it's like, wow, that's really quite awesome. The thing that we emphasize in all of our classes is that hands-on experience, Chris. And we have the theory, of course, but every class in design, as well as our technology programs, are very, very hands-on. and we look for those real life opportunities wherever we can. So this was a perfect fit with what kind of experience we like our students to have when they leave here.
Well, now, Jason, now that this part's been taken care of, it's been created by the 3D printer and sent off to Jay Leno's Big Dog Garage out there in Burbank, California. Any response back from the folks out at California about how the part seems to fit in into what Jay Leno had hoped to have done on the vehicle?
Actually, they called me back the next day after they received it, and they were ecstatic. And it looks like they may give us some more parts. So we're pretty excited about that. And we're grateful that they did that. We think that we're trying to open up this printer to industry, especially here in Indiana. So if there's any companies out there that would like to work with us, we'd really be happy to do that. And, of course, any students that are interested, please give us a call. Classes start up in the spring, so we'd love to have you. And it's an exciting field. Think about it. You can almost replicate anything. As long as we have a scanner, we can almost replicate anything. So it's an exciting field right now. And I hope we can work with Jay again. Richard and I were tossing up who was going to drive this part down to California, but unfortunately, we had classes and we had to mail it.
Oh, too bad. Well, maybe if you get more business from the Big Dog Garage for other vehicles that Jay Leno or some other people that have vehicles in the garage that will have to be worked on and need to be replaced, maybe you'll get some other business and they'll give you that opportunity to be able to drive out to Burbank, California and deliver it in person.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd like to drive one of his Stanley Steamers, actually.
That's true. You get a chance if you go out to the garage, you get to see his fleet that's out there parked in the area out there too. It'll be great to see that as well too. Valentina, as far as working with the students are concerned on this project, what kind of reaction that the students have about having an opportunity to do a little robotics work as well as actually see something made and actually turn into something that somebody will use?
Actually, they are so excited. Students are always excited about projects when they can use some critical thinking skills and do the hands-on, you know, project-based learning, and they just get in so engaged, you know, they form in teams, and it just works so well for them, and it's a great thing they can put in their resume and get a better internship or a job opportunity. Just so, so exciting for them. I think students are more excited than the instructors.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, it might be a toss-up on that, too. But it's also good to know, too, that you know that the word will get around among the students that if they're interested in taking this class here for this next year coming up, that they'll get involved in making more projects as well, too. It'd be interesting to see what does come about it here. We've been talking with Valentina Petrushki, as well as with instructor Richard Maroche, and with the Dean of Technology at Ivy Tech Community College, Valparaiso Campus, Susan Perry, and Jason Gordon, who is the chairman of the Design Technology Program. It's been the program that's been very involved in creating a 3D model of a car part for Jay Leno to be able to use in one of his fleet of the beautiful antique vehicles that he has at the Big Dog Garage out in Burbank, California. And thank you all for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about this and hope to get more word of more great parts, not only for Jay Leno, but for other people as well, too, that are made there at the Ivy Tech Community College campus in Valparaiso.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris.
Universities are seeing success in recruiting more women into their computer science programs, but making sure they want to stay in the major is a different challenge. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle is going to close out her second of her two-part series by telling us that colleges can struggle to make the classroom as inclusive as possible.
In the computer science department at Rose Holman Institute of Technology, there's only one bathroom. The building only has room for one, and for a while it was men only.
But when the computer science department moved up there, they came into that area and they insisted that it was changed to a female bathroom. And the reason was because it sent a message that, you know, we're a boys' club, right? And they didn't want to do that.
That's David Fisher, a Rose Holman computer science professor. He says it's just one piece of the gender-inclusive puzzle the school is grappling with as the number of women in the major increases. But the environment university officials are most focused on changing is in the classroom. Current student Olivia Ada and alumna Amanda Stouter say in class, girls are often isolated.
But you definitely see male dominance. I know
and,
I'm in...
Two, I was gonna say, and you have to prove yourself in those...
100%, yeah. I'm in two computer science classes right now. One I'm in, there's only one other girl out of like 30.
That's where student organizations such as Girls Who Code or Wolfpack come in. Their goal is to connect women in the field and provide a support system. Ada says she's relied on upperclassmen to help guide her through the tougher times.
Versus being out in the big scary world with a whole bunch of guys and you're by yourself and you feel as if like you're not supposed to be there at times. Mm-hmm. And you have like the side comments and stuff like that. And you're like, why do I want to go through this? But when we have other women like, hey, I'm going through it too, it gets better. Mm-hmm. It makes it a lot easier.
A recent study shows support can have an effect on whether girls study CS or not. For example, if a high school girl doesn't have any friends studying the same thing, she's 1/3 less likely to continue studying it. But the issue isn't just about classmates. It's also about faculty. And with a shortage of women in the field, female CS professors are especially difficult to find. So Rose Holman's department is trying to homegrow its teaching staff. Beyond who teaches the class, universities are also changing how the classes are taught. In Rose Holman's freshman-level CS class, professors assume all of the students have no prior experience. Department head J.P. Meller says only a few drop the major, and about 20 students a year actually change their major to computer science after taking the class, most of them women.
So I think that's a positive thing, right? We're not having students show up and then, you know, I don't fit in and changing majors because of that.
At Purdue University, the introductory CS class is split into those who have programming experience and those who don't, referred to as the black and gold sections of the student body. Department head Sunil Prabhakar says students are less intimidated and more successful when everyone is on the same page.
That distinction, just seeing that you belong, has been a huge, huge boost to the program. And the success of women in the gold section last semester was at par as the overall student success.
Both universities' female CS student percentage is a few points higher than today's national average of 16%. Nationwide, the number of women studying CS reached a peak in the mid-80s, a peak that even current recruiting efforts might struggle to match. That's because about five times as many women earned bachelor's degrees 30 years ago as do now. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle in West Lafayette.
Thank you, Charlotte. And for that is all for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.